And welcome to the Department of Metal Antiquities. Normally, this is where Duncan would say, "Well, we remember what everyone else has forgotten." But unfortunately, we could not do our standard recording this week, unfortunately, and I apologize profusely. Hopefully, the sound of my brand new microphone is making up for the lack of new content. But if you are not a longtime listener, if you are just somebody who's been here for a little while, I wanted to definitely keep things going for you so that way you don't miss anything. So this week we are going to bring you a classic episode of the Department of Metal Antiquities, which goes back to the height of the pandemic of the year 2020. So if you have any other questions, please let us know. In the meantime, it would be extraordinarily helpful if you could take some time to leave us a star review. And if you can download the episode rather than stream it, also very helpful. But that is everything I have for you today, and I appreciate you for listening. I appreciate you for your continued support. And we will be back to you next week. Talk soon.
And welcome to the Department of Metal Antiquities,
where we remember what everyone else has forgotten.
This is Nick Cameron of Glacier Musical, and with me, as always, is Duncan Evans. How are you doing today, Duncan?
Hello. Hi, yes, I'm doing very well over here in Leeds, UK. Yes, very good.
Well, things are normal here, as you know, normal as they're going to be. Well, cool thing this week is I did get a new needle for my turntable, which I have been posting about that stupid thing everywhere, but that little change has made me just want to listen to every record I have again, because it has made that big of a difference.
That's cool. Yeah, I, on a similar note, actually, I'm slightly frustrated because my phono box, the preamp for my turntable, has not been working. It's been causing a horrible earth hum noise or ground hum noise.
The ground is messed up. It's getting a hum.
Yeah, and I tried to buy a new power adapter for it, hoping that might fix it, but that doesn't seem to do anything. It just doesn't work at all. So I am without vinyl at the moment, which is very frustrating. I've been without vinyl for quite some time, but there we are. I'm going to buy a new phono box and cross my fingers.
I do mine through all vintage equipment, except for my new stylus. My new stylus is a brand new modern day stylus. It's an Ortofone 10M, and one of the things that I've been trying to become an expert in vinyl lately, and what I have learned is that 90% of your sound is based on that needle and that cartridge. So I went ahead and I bought it, got a really good price off eBay, and I bought the kind where the head shell, the cartridge, and the stylus were already put together and all set up. I just had to plug and play, and it has made an amazing difference.
Yeah, I believe I've got the same one. It's definitely an Ortofone. I think it's the same one that I've got. And yeah, I tried to fit it myself originally and it went badly wrong. So I had to get a guy to do it. And it turns out, I don't know what it's like over there, but around here, there are not that many people that are real experts on vinyl turntables, record players. So it was, you know, a pretty elderly guy in his maybe late 70s, early 80s, still doing it part-time. And he did a great job. But I don't know who's going to be around to do it after he's gone, but you know, we'll see.
Then that's precisely why I ordered one, because they were selling it two different ways. They were selling it for, I think it was 53 in all three pieces, or 58 in connected together.
Yeah.
And I sent him an email saying, "Hey, this is the put together version, right?" "Yes." "Okay, that's what I want. Click yes, buy it."
Yeah, that would have saved me some money. I think I didn't know you could do that. Oh well, you live and learn.
I got this from a seller out of New York. I can't recommend this enough. It's definitely, but probably go on for this for a while. What are we talking about today?
Okay, so we're talking
No, before we get there, I just wanted to give a shout out to one podcast, Fourth Line Voice, great old school hockey podcast.
Fantastic. I've been listening to the Jabberjaw Daily Music Business Podcast as well, actually, which is very useful if you are involved in the music industry in any way, shape or form. Cool. So today, yeah, we are talking about a band called Quiet Riot that a lot of people probably will have heard of. They had a seminal breakthrough classic album in 1983 called Metal Health. But we're not talking about that because that's not forgotten. People know about that one and we're dealing with the forgotten things. So this is Quiet Riot 2, which is unsurprisingly their second album, released, I believe, in 1978. 1979. Oh, that's, I've got 1978 in front of me, but that's obviously an unreliable Wikipedia source. So there we go.
The first one was 78.
Okay, okay. Yeah, so, well, tell us what you know about this album then, Nick, because there are some really notable features here.
It starts off with, to call this band Quiet Riot is a little bit wrong, because it's not the Quiet Riot that we all know. If you talk about the seminal Metal Health, this, there is one person on both of these records. Now, Rudy Sarzo's picture is on both of them, but he did not play on this one. It was a man named Kelly something or other. I don't remember his name, but he was on the first one and the second one.
Have a look. Kelly Garney. Yeah, that's, he was for some reason uncredited, but Rudy Sarzo was. So I don't know. Maybe they fell out with him or something before the
release. Yeah, he left right afterwards, and then it created the Rudy Sarzo, Randy Rhoads, Kevin Dubrow, and I don't even remember the drummer's name because it's... When you think of Quiet
Drew
Riot,
Forsyth. Drew yeah. Forsyth is the drummer.
Thank you.
Yeah.
With Quiet Riot, it's always, you know, Kevin Dubrow, Rudy Sarzo, Carlos, and Frankie Benali. That Carlos, yeah, Carlos. Is it Carlos? Oh, God. I'm a mess today.
That's all right, man. That's all right. We shall find answers to all of these questions, don't you worry. Yeah, Carlos Cavazo.
That's it, Cavazo. So the only person in common on this album in Metal Health is Kevin Dubrow. After Randy joined Ozzy's band, because this was released in 79, the same year that Randy joined Ozzy's band. So it was a very short-lived, the lineup with Rudy Sarzo was a very short-lived lineup, but it was only 2 years later, if even 2 years, till Rudy Sarzo joined Ozzy Osbourne at Randy Rhoads' behest.
Which I thought was indeed.
He didn't, I don't believe he recorded on anything. I think it was, you know, it was Bob Daisley that did all the recording, but it's, you know, he was still part of the band.
I think that's right. Totally.
He was on Speak of the Devil. We talked about that last week.
Absolutely, indeed.
But it's interesting. So... That whole thing is just, it's how everybody just kind of gets in bed together. After Randy left Quiet Riot, it basically broke up, and Kevin had reformed as Dubrow, but realizing nobody would know who that was after Randy's death is when he reformed Quiet Riot as Quiet Riot.
Yes. Yeah, so when we look at the history of Quiet Riot, they actually began at a very young age in 1973, I believe. So they've been doing bits and bobs, small shows or whatever, since 1973. But yeah, as you've said, they didn't really hit the big time till 1983 with that album, Metal Health. So this is kind of a transitional record, I suppose.
Still, we haven't mentioned, when I really think we should, these two albums were only released in Japan, even though it was on CBS. And as far as I know, I haven't done a whole lot of digging, these albums have never even been released on CD.
Yeah, that sounds right to me. Yeah, and I know that Randy Rhoads' mother and allegedly Randy Rhoads himself didn't want these records to be released retrospectively in the US. So they didn't really want people to hear what Randy had been involved with before... him being in the Aussie band.
I think a big part of it wasn't as much the music as it was the look. when you look at the cover. Now, this album was called Quiet Riot 2. Originally, it was going to be entitled Quiet Riot 2nd and 10, which 2nd and 10 is an American football reference, 2nd down, 10 yards to go. The cover of the album is Quiet Riot in all their stage gear in a football, an American football locker room. Looks like, looks like Cal State to me. Sky blue jerseys, golden.
And they're
helmet.
Surrounded by players, aren't they? I'm guessing that they're probably real players. So you've got the band and you've got three guys in their full American football gear, kind of as though they're getting ready before a match.
Right, exactly. And why they continued with that cover without that title, I don't know. But if you get a look, I don't know how closely you can get a look at it, but if you can get a look at Randy on that, he's wearing sky blue velvet pants.
Yeah.
He's wearing just the vest from a tuxedo vest. No shirt on underneath. And that vest is white and sky blue.
Yeah, this I've got it here.
And a giant boat and an oversized bow tie. The bow tie is probably about 5 inches end to end. That would, 6 inches, that would be 15 centimeters. For everyone else, and it's blue and white polka dot. I mean, he looks flatly ridiculous. Yeah. And
it's not very metal. It's not very metal. And it's very, very 70s, really. Very, very flamboyant 70s.
It's not even metal for Quiet Riot in 1983.
Absolutely.
And then you've got the drummer there in pantyhose. And a leotard.
Yeah.
Kevin is wearing a... Good Lord, what would you call that?
It's kind of a baby pink jumpsuit, isn't it?
He looks like he's walked right off of the Donnie and Marie show.
Absolutely. It's very... It's kind of glam, but it's also Saturday night TV game show. It's, I don't know, man.
Then you got Rudy Sarzo there wearing a one-piece red jumper with a checkered scarf. I mean, he doesn't look awful, but it's a bad look.
It's a little bit strange. Yeah, I'm just doing some Googling here for if you just Google Quiet Riot Randy Rhoads, he does seem to have a habit of, he seemed to wear a bow tie very often during this era, a very flamboyant big polka dot bow tie. There's so many photos of him with this, which as far as I'm aware, he didn't continue once he was in Ozzy's band. I'm sure that was part of,
on his polka dot flying V, the fret markers were bow ties.
Right, so that was obviously part of his signature look. And yeah, so I would imagine that that is part of why he and his mother didn't want these records to be released retrospectively. I would imagine it might also be a bit to do with the sound, because although on this one, more than on Quiet Riot 1, we can hear quite a few glimpses and hints of what Randy Rhoads went on to become and that sound that he came to embody. But overall, it's not very metal, really. You know, this is hard rock at best. And we're really talking more about almost a pop rock type of...
Yeah, I described it in my notes over and over as AOR.
Totally.
This is AOR. It's a lot. There's some really good moments.
Yeah.
I won't say there's really good songs. There's really good moments.
No, I think
where you could see, because
I think they hadn't found themselves yet.
Completely. In this, we've got two visionaries, as I'm seeing it, Kevin Dubrow and Randy Rhoads. And the rhythm section is, frankly, throwaways. Because they were thrown away. So I did more than just listen to the Quiet Riot record. I also listened to Metal Health afterwards. Mm-hmm. So I got the before and the after with Quiet Riot. I've also listened to to Blizzard of Oz very recently as well, to get just kind of, because I'm seeing this more than just Randy. I'm seeing it as Randy and Kevin, because Quiet Riot went on to some pretty amazing heights. Mm-hmm. You can question everything else, but you can't question how successful they were at the very beginning. And it was, I'll say it, Metal Health is still a great record. And I listened to that again today, like I said, a couple of times now. And it's, so it's, I'm looking at it more than just listening for Randy. I was listening to Kevin and listening to Randy. And with both of them, this, when you say the transitional period, that's exactly right. This is the pupil stage for these two performers. They're both about to bust out of the cocoon fully formed, but they're just not there yet. And one of the things that I noticed over and over before we get it, I'll say this before we get to the track by track, because I think it's better to say it once than to say it over and over and over. Most of the riffs in this are just, there's not much melody on the guitar during the vocals, during the verses. And it's just Randy letting Kevin handle all of that. And I think that might be another reason why they didn't want it to be heard.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, a lot of those guitar parts could be anyone until it gets to a solo.
Correct.
And even some of the solos could be anyone, but
oh, correct.
I would say at least about half of the solos do have some of that Randy signature sound to them.
There are three or four solos on this record that would have fit completely on Blizzard or on Diary, just Randy Rhoads nailing it. So not a lot, when he did those, he went on for a minute.
Yeah. And I might be wrong, but I just get this feeling that Randy was maybe starting to want to break free a little bit of the type of sound that Quiet Riot were offering. Because when his solos happen, quite often the whole band changes. Like, we go into a completely different section with a different riff, a different chord sequence, and it's like a cutout from a different song. And it's like he wanted to do something heavier. But then Kevin DuBrow's going, no, look, I've got this really cool poppy rock and roll song. So then Randy's gone, okay, well, we'll use that. But then in the middle, I want to put my bit in. That's what it feels like to me.
It completely feels like cut and paste, where they've got four parts of songs. They took one of Randy's parts, threw it in, and then sandwiched Kevin's parts around it. And it's like, there we go, everybody wins. But sure. I can understand why these weren't released in America. I can understand. I also don't think for a second this band could have lasted much longer. It doesn't.
Yeah.
In many ways, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
But although it would have worked, Metal Health would have worked with Randy Rhoads in the band.
Sure. I think we discussed this when we did an Instagram Live on this quite a while back, that. Yeah, it's like Quiet Riot, as they became in 1983, had been influenced by what Randy went on to go and do with Ozzy. So it's a strange thing where Randy's the one that left, but then when they come back without Randy, they sound more like what Randy then did than they did when Randy was in the band. Now that sounds much more complicated than it.
And then keep in mind, they also have the very skinny, slight guitar player with bleach blonde hair playing a Les Paul.
Very true. So there's quite likely a heavy influence there as well. Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure there is. But I think we are good to go track by track for a bit here, see what you think.
Okay. But
starting off with Slick Black Cadillac. You know, that's always been one of my favorite Quiet Riot songs.
Sure, sure. Look, he's got a catchy chorus. There's a bit of Queen in there, I thought. In fact, there's a few songs where I think they start to sound a bit like Queen with these vocal harmonies. Not quite as flamboyant as Queen, but hinting at that. The riffs are quite good. I've written here, great singing. The singing is absolutely top form. I suppose what we start to get into is the theme of the songs. You know, we're talking about these slightly cliched, especially by today's standards. You know, okay, this was the 70s, so, you know, it perhaps wasn't as cliche then, but I think it was pretty cliche even then. Slick back, yeah. Kind of like stuff about cars, stuff about, cars and women and relationships and these kind of fairly done to death themes. It doesn't mean the songs are bad. But look, pretty catchy. Some pretty all right riffs. Bit Queen, some cool harmonies. Great singing.
These are kids writing about things they don't even know anything about. And, yeah. You know, it's, look at, you know, when you look at some of the great lyricists, you know, it took Roger Waters 4 or 5 albums to get good.
Oh, yes.
James Hetfield 3 or 4 albums. It took him 2 albums to even have something that's not stupid. Because if you look at the vast majority of that first Metallica record, the lyrical themes are dumb and cliche and overdone. And these are kids writing about nothing, trying to write about something. And that's what Slick Black Cadillac is. It's like, man, how awesome would it be? Because back in those days, in the 70s and 80s, a black Cadillac in America was the symbol that you had made it, that you were one of the upper echelon, the elites. But what I like about this one the most is it's the only song with Randy playing on it from what we know of Quiet Riot. So it's cool to hear that. It sounds like the Quiet Riot we know and love, and it sounds a little bit like the Randy we know and love. Not a whole lot, but it's you can tell something's going on there. But you know, it's a fun song, and that's all that matters.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so then we go on to You Drive Me Crazy. I thought this was a bit more cliche.
I got cliche written down.
Yeah, what interested me, and again, I noticed this on a few of the songs, we've got these choruses, particularly, that hark back to, I would say, a more classic vintage era of sort of rock and roll and pop music. So I said, this one even sounds a bit 50s. And when you look into Kevin Dubrow, you can see that he was heavily influenced by certainly 60s music. So we've got kind of a feel-good groove. It's a little bit power balladish. I felt the singing wasn't great on this. I thought he was trying to do a different style that doesn't work for him so much on this one.
It's him. It's still a nascent Kevin Dubrow. It's still him, because he doesn't have a great voice. He doesn't have a good range. He's only got about probably a 4 or 5 note range, and it's really hard to find out how you fit into that. And he did, you know, Ozzy Osbourne, same way. He's got a really small, not a great singer, small range. But this one cracked me up because, you know, the acoustic intro, it's all sensitive. It's, you know, it's the boy singing to his girl. And then, you know, Kevin's singing like a sensitive boy. And it gets into that, as you said, that older, more vintage, clapping, stomping, singing along choruses. To me, this felt like the first power ballad. Hair metal was the originator of the power ballad, and there's a couple of those on this album where it seems like they're a little ahead of the curve.
Yeah, that's true. No, I can accept that. Yeah, for sure.
Won't say they did any of them well, but they did them.
Yeah. I've put here there are some little hints at Randy's later guitar style. And I've put, there's a pretty good solo. He's not really being the Randy Rhoads that we know, but I've put, it sounds quite Lynyrd Skynyrd. It sounds like, I know they had 3 guitarists, Lynyrd Skynyrd, and then different ones came and went at different times, but it's like he's emulating, I can't remember all the guitarists' name now, but one of those guys, and the groove Rossington, of the music feels a bit like that. Yeah, Gary Rossington, that's right, could well be.
This could be said probably of all the songs on this album. These are kids trying to write a hit. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Every song on here is, you can tell they're just trying to write a hit. You know.
Yeah, I think you've hit on something there, which is that there is a little bit of an element of maybe trying a little bit too hard.
Why this doesn't feel like an album.
Yeah,
it feels like a collection of the things that we we wrote and recorded, and let's see what one of them sticks. We're just trying to get one top 10 single here.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a very good point. Yeah, and it feels a little bit like they're trying too hard to, like they sort of want to rock out and they sort of want to be mainstream as well. And they haven't worked it out yet. Are they hard rock? Are they soft rock? Are they MOR, AOR? Are they a pop group? Yeah. So no, I think that's a very good point.
And that's, you know, and then the next one, Afterglow. Okay, I didn't know this was a cover. So I'm going to apologize.
No, I actually didn't. And I should know because I have got, it's the Small Faces, isn't it? And I have got a few of their records. So I might even have it somewhere. But yeah, it's Small Faces. A big influence on Kevin Dubrow. Yeah, it's funny because when I was listening to this again, and when I first listened to it again today, I'd again forgotten that it wasn't, that it was a cover. And I've put, oh, the it sounds like a very 60s style chorus. And of course, it's a 60s song. So,
and this one, to me, this is the second single off the album. You know, if I'm the A&R man on this one, Slick Black Cadillac is the opener. You know, that boisterous, yeah, grandiose introduction. And then you slow it down a little with Afterglow. And, you know, Kevin's in the bar smoking a cigarette, drinking his iced tea out of his Jack Daniels bottle, looking at his buddy, singing about his girl that left him. And you know, that's, yeah, and it's black and white and grainy. You know, I could see the whole thing as we were watching this. This one, it was boring. It was cheesy. No, really, no guitar work. I mean, no great performances. It wasn't bad, but it definitely is the second single of the album, but it's still a throwaway to me.
Yeah, it's fine, but there's not much else to it. Yeah. It's funny you've used that word throwaway, because on the next track, which is called Eye for an Eye, I have used exactly the same word. I've said that it's a bit throwaway. I've put that it's quite catchy. It's got a Beach Boys or Ramones kind of vibe to it in places. That a little bit of that kind of beach rock and roll, surf rock type of thing. And some Queen-style harmonies, but it's a bit of something and nothing for me. I don't know if you agree or not.
My here are my notes. I'll read them to you verbatim. Here's the, what the hell is this? The lyrics and the melody don't match. Oh, yeah, there's a little bit of Randy there, and there's a good solo. Those are my notes on that song. It's a song that doesn't make sense. They had these seven parts, and they tried to get four of them into a song, and they used the wrong parts.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, again, it just, hearkening, it goes back to, it feels like they're just trying to write a hit. They're just trying to get their foot in the door rather than writing the songs they want to write.
Totally, totally. Yeah, okay. So then we move on to track five, which is called Trouble. I won't talk about all of it. I'll let you go on this one, but I'll just say the intro is very reminiscent.
Good Times, Bad Times.
Times by Led Zeppelin. Yeah, you've got this down out thing.
Which it's just the same thing.
Yeah, it's the whole sound of it as well. It's the drums. It's just everything about it. It feels like pretty intentional that they've copied that. What else do you think?
That's what I have. Good Times, Bad Times. That's exactly what I heard. And when you do that, I mean, that is such, and I hate this word. I really do, but I'm going to use it. It's such an iconic intro. It was also the first, you know, that was the opening song to the Led Zeppelin reunion concert, which makes it even bigger.
Yeah. And it's so the first song on the first album as well. It's the first song on Led Zeppelin 1.
And so for somebody else to use that motif, it just doesn't work. It just ruins everything. And then it just goes into, you know, 70s AOR, there's some lead guitar in the background that sounds like an alarm clock. I mean,
yeah, I've put silly lyrics, brackets, intentionally. Like, the lyrics are ridiculous. I can't remember them all now. I apologize. That's actually what I've put for the next song. So we'll come on to that in a minute. The lyrics might have been awful on this one as well, but sorry.
Trouble was a cover, so that was another cover.
So, okay.
I think. Let me check. Let me pull up the Wikipedia track.
No, no, it wasn't. I've just looked. No, it is.
No, it's not. I take that back. You're right. Yeah. So I don't know. It was. It was not a good song. It was just, in any possibility it had for being a good song was ruined by taking that intro. And because you can't do that and go anywhere else. Because all anybody's going to hear when they hear that is good times, bad times.
Yeah, it's too obvious. Far, far, far too obvious.
Correct. It's okay to steal. It's okay to borrow. But you can't plagiarize.
Yeah, and you know what? Look, I get it. Led Zeppelin borrowed loads of stuff, and they probably, you know, maybe they plagiarized stuff. But the thing is, they always did something new and cool with it. And this,
that's what I mean.
It's one chord. You're allowed to play one chord twice. Duh, duh, fine. But it just sound. They've made it sound exactly like that section.
It was that. It was that. It was that exact same thing. They could have just lifted it. Yeah. But then we move on into Killer Girls.
Now this is the one where I've written ridiculous lyrics or
yeah, me too.
Silly lyrics and I put in brackets intentionally. I don't know, man. Look, let me killer girls waiting in line for me, bloodthirsty, get home in time for tea. I don't know, man. Killer girls in a frenzy on me, no more juice, take my advice, you better think twice. I don't know, man. It's pretty bad.
No, you do know. You know. And it is not, I'm going to say it's not intentional. I'm going to say that they wrote that thinking, nailed it. Getting back on time for tea. I mean, that's still, even when Americans still drank tea a little bit, but you know, anyway, he was going for exactly what he did. It was intentional. That's what he was shooting for. He just didn't realize how awful it was. Again, we're just talking about, you know, how old are they at this point? How old is Kevin DeBrow?
Well, I looked, he's actually, when it was released, he was 24. So he's not actually that young. I mean, yeah, okay, early 20s. But yeah, it's not like they were 17 or something, you know?
Okay, then he should have been better at this point.
yeah, I agree, really. So,
because, you know, you go to the next album, and I'm not going to sit here and tell you or anyone else in the world that Quiet Riot is inspirational lyrically. But they're fun, they're kitschy, and they're creative.
Yep.
I can't say this about these lyrics.
No, totally.
And that's the thing. Between this album and 5 years later, it was 78, not 79. I apologize, by the way.
Okay.
You take this five-year gap, and Kevin DeBrow has, I don't know if he was, you know, nicking some stuff from the other Sunset Strip bands or how he was doing it, but he got better. You know, he at least got to the Gene Simmons level of lyrical songwriting. Mm.
Yeah, you know? Sure.
And then we move into Face to Face, which, I mean, it was just totally forgettable for me. It's another chorus where they had the gigantic 80s choral chorus. I don't know how else to say that. And that's something we didn't have in the 70s, but that became a hallmark of what hair metal became.
Yes. I think,
you know, when you look at these things, this is bad Quiet Riot, it's bad hair metal, it's bad glam, whatever you want to call it. But the seeds are there to what ended up becoming a musical revolution.
Yeah, man, no, for sure. Yeah, I've put standard rock and roll, pretty cheesy / cliche. But I have put, this is one of the songs where, and actually there was one on what we didn't mention, is that on Killer Girls, there was a solo, which was quite fast and technical and pretty stylish. And actually, we've got a bit of Randy being Randy, and I thought that was cool.
That was one of the ones where he was... just going way high on the neck, because I could picture him playing that, because he had a really strange style where his index finger, he would do a bar chord, he would bar the top, and then he would shred with the other three fingers.
Sure.
And he was doing that where I could see him going down, dropping, and then pulling his other hand up top, letting go, all that crazy stuff that he became very famous for. It was in that song.
Totally. But it's here as well, in Face to Face. We've got one of those situations like I described earlier on, where we suddenly move from this standard cliche rock and roll song to a totally different section, much darker, a bit metally, you know, in the sense that we've come to know the term metal. Dark, technical, lots of that whammy bar, you know, but in a cool way. The thing that Randy managed to do was he made this stuff a bit classy, and it had a certain swagger and a certain confidence and a certain level of substance to it that a lot of his contemporaries didn't quite get. For a lot of his contemporaries, I think it was very much style over substance, but he has a substance too. So that's pretty cool, I thought. But overall, the song's totally disjointed. It's a total mess because they've just plonked these different sections next to each other, which none of them are really that great apart from the solo, and they don't really work together.
I disagree with that a little bit.
Okay.
I thought Kevin sang very well on this one. This was my favorite vocal performance by Kevin on this record.
Fair enough. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I mean, there are some great vocal performances on here, and yeah, I guess this is a pretty good one. So yeah, I'll go with that.
But it was the solo more than anything I wanted to talk about on this song. You know,
yes.
It's a totally forgettable, cliche, you know, trying to score the hit that, you know, trying to rewrite the hit that was big last week. But the solo, this was the first time that Randy did one of those very moody, very out there kind of solos. And in my notes, I have it listed as this would fit great for Blizzard of Oz. But no, this is the kind of playing that he did two albums later, and he was doing on Diary of a Madman. Diary of a Madman is far moodier than Blizzard, in my opinion. And this is another time we get to see a little peek into Randy's future.
Yes.
That's the best thing I can say about that song.
No, I agree. Totally agree.
But and the thing is even though that's such a cool moment and such a cool thing, we've all heard that kind of Randy Rhoads already on Diary of a Madman.
Yeah, this is true.
And then we move on to Inside of You.
Inside You, is it called? Yeah, just, yeah, Inside You. Yeah, well, what do you think about this one?
It's a good riff. It's you know, and there are not that many good riffs on this record. That's the thing that I consider to be the biggest surprise, is when you really look at these songs, it's just generic 3 and 4 chord progressions, if even that, for the most part. On this one, there was some good rhythm playing. But then it goes back to the old generic, you know, blandness. So it's, you could see, I wonder, because Randy has the ability to play some great rhythm licks.
Mm-hmm.
I know that. We heard it a year later. Yes, I would say there's probably a jump in Randy's quality during that time, but not so much that all of a sudden he could play rhythm. And I just feel like Kevin had to have insinuated himself there. And asked for the, you know, the Paul Stanley kind of stuff that, you know, easy to play and sing at the same time.
I think that's entirely possible. Yeah, absolutely. I've put that it would be anthemic if the melodies were a bit stronger. Like, you can tell they're hinting at this anthemic, big rock sing-along sound, but it's just the melodies aren't quite strong enough.
We've been trying for that this whole album.
Yeah. I've also put that there's some weird singing. Like, he, at the start, again, it's this bit where, this thing where he's not quite decided on what his voice should be yet. So he's still trying out different styles. And he goes a bit into this wobbly, warbly thing, a bit like, I don't know if you know the band Family, and the singer Roger Chapman has this voice that's very odd that kind of goes, almost. It's not. But it sort of goes, hey! And it sounds like he's almost trying to do a bit of that.
I do think, you know, the more we go over this and dig deeper into it and I think about it more, I will tell you, at this point in time, I was checking out a little bit because it just felt like, you don't like that power ballad? How about this one? Oh, that power ballad didn't get you? How about we sing along with this one? So it got to the point where I was checking out a little bit. But, you know, we're talking about Randy, who I think musically has his chops.
Oh, yeah.
Songwriter, he's willing to take a back seat.
And yeah. The
problem is, I think he's taking a back seat to someone he shouldn't.
Yeah, I think that's very possibly right. And yeah, this thing of like the chorus is, you know, I want to be inside you. I don't know. It's not, I just don't think it's brilliant, really. It's, I don't know. I think if you're going to go down that route, you've either got to make it really silly and ridiculous or maybe make it a bit more subtle, you know?
Only AC/DC can get away with that lack of subtlety.
Exactly, because they make it slightly cheeky and silly and there's humor in there.
But it took 5 years for us to get to that point where we accepted that with them.
Yeah, yeah.
Now it's like, oh, that's just AC/DC. Here yeah. We are, we're looking at this, and I don't even know what kind of band I would call them. They're definitely not the hair metal band they became.
No, they're not.
What are they? I don't know.
Yeah, I would say they're like, it's that strange thing. They're almost like a soft rock, hard rock band, aren't they? It's like they've got elements of hard rock, but they're very melodic and trying to be quite commercial. Right. Yeah.
I don't know what it is. It's, I guess the closest I could say is it's yacht rock. It's an attempt at yacht rock, but you have one guy in the band who really doesn't want to do that.
Yeah. But what is notable though, is that we move then on to the last track. We've got The Magic, which actually, believe it or not, is credited just to Randy Rhoads. It's the only song on the album credited just to Randy Rhoads. So this is Randy's songwriting. It's not very metal. It's not very Ozzy Osbourne. It's even got a solo in it that's just totally standard that could be anyone playing it. Yeah.
That's exactly what I said about the same solo. It was it was a nice but conventional solo.
Yeah, it was totally just do a 70s.
A lot of that. There's a lot of that over the entire record. You have the arpeggio. You have just boring major chord arpeggios. You've got, you know, the acoustic sensitive material. You've got there's just not one song on here. Maybe Slick Black Cadillac. But it doesn't really feel like there's one song on here where they came together with a unified message and then they delivered it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's
yeah,
the whole
yeah.
album.
Yeah, so I've put about We've Got the Magic. You know, it's pretty cheesy. It's very Queen. You've got those Queen-style harmonies in the chorus. It's a bit power pop, you know. I guess the whole power pop thing was happening around that time, the late 70s. We've got a bit of that going on. But it's just not quite strong enough. Again, it's trying to be this big, powerful, sing-along, catchy anthem.
Oh, yeah, very much.
But there's not enough to get your teeth into to sing along. And for example, now while I'm speaking about it, and I only listened to it shortly before we came on, you know, an hour or two ago, whatever it was, I can't quite recall that chorus. You know, it was it was trying to be this big memorable thing. Why can't I remember it?
Same. And here we both listened to this today, just hours ago. I listen to this in my kitchen, telling my kid over and over to stop talking. I'm listening, but focusing on this as though it were a brand new record that I had just brought home, and I was sitting on my couch staring at the record spinning, and I can't remember a damn thing except Slick Black Cadillac. That is the only song in my head I can remember, because everything was so. I can remember a couple of the solos here and there, but. Yeah. Everything else, it was just such paint by numbers, boring 70s soft rock. It could have been nearly anyone. Especially if you take out the guitar solos.
I agree. So, yeah, look, I think in conclusion, it's worth listening to for those guitar solo moments. And probably Slick Black Cadillac, you know. And it's worth listening to if you know Quiet Riot later on, what they became, but you don't know this era of Quiet Riot. Look, it's probably not going to become many people's favorite album, let's face it. There are some good moments, you know, and we have to take it for what it is, which I guess is a band that were developing. They weren't at their end point. They hadn't reached the peak of what they could become.
They hadn't found themselves yet.
Yeah, and the strange thing is, it wasn't even them, was it? Because by the time they do the next album in 1983, it's just Kevin Dubrow and some other guys. Anyway, so I guess we talk about Kevin and we talk about Randy and we say, look, at this point, they were going in different directions and neither of them had quite found what they wanted to do. Whereas Randy found himself with metal, with Ozzy, and then Kevin was influenced by that and then found himself with metal again with Quiet Riot later on. It's very odd in a way that Randy wrote that last song, We've Got the Magic.
I wanted to say this because it deserves this much at least. It reminded me of like the template for Unskinny Pop, which came 10 years later, or actually 12 years later. And you know, that the thumping bass line, little bit of guitar licks, and just big anthemic choruses.
Okay.
I held on the choruses part, but it just felt like that to me. But you know, it's, I had in my notes, you know, We Got the Magic, my first note is doubt it. That is just how I felt about that whole album. Is it worth listening to? Yes. Is it worth tracking down one of the original copies from Japan? No. Because I read, read this today, can't verify, but I read that it has never even been put on CD. All there were these copies in Japan from back in the day, and that's all there is. That and somebody digitized it and put it on YouTube. So enjoy that as best you can.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I wouldn't say it was worth seeking out a copy. I'm just looking now. Here we go. So Quiet Riot 2, 1979 Japan LP promo sample, £294.49, which is probably close to $350. So there you go.
I saw one on Amazon for $300. Wasn't a promo, it was $300. So if you're looking at £299, that's closer to, I think, 400 right now.
Yeah, probably
400
is.
American. And yeah. I mean, we're talking about a significant portion of money to spend on terrible music. You should only buy this if you are looking to say, I've got this rare record. That's the only reason to own this.
Yeah, or in the hope that it'll be worth double that in a few years, which probably won't happen.
I disagree. Based on what I've seen about vinyl collecting, I would say yes. Even the really terrible middle 90s Black Sabbath albums are like $1,000 now.
Okay. Well, there we go. There we go. So as an investment opportunity, maybe. As a listening opportunity, probably
definitely
not.
Definitely not. Yeah. I think we're in agreement on this one. And
totally. Totally.
I got nothing else on Quiet Riot too.
No, that's it. Really kind of educational, you know, if you're into music history and all that, it's part of it. But not going to become my favorite anytime soon.
No. And I will never listen to this again.
All right. Cool. Yeah, I guess that's it.
All right. Well, I want to thank everybody for checking in. Probably somebody that's not normally listening to us saw that this is about Randy Rhoads and checked in for that. And just hopefully you'll check back in with us next week.
Thank you. Thanks for listening, guys.
Thank you. See you.